First is Donald Minildi. For the last 6 years, he's been curator of the International Piano Archives at the University of Maryland, College Park. He serves also as consulting editor to two publications, the International Piano Quarterly and Piano and Keyboard. He holds degrees in piano performance from the University of Washington, the Cleveland Institute of Music, and he's published nearly 600 articles and reviews on pianists and piano recordings. Donald.
In recent years, the value of recorded musical performances as documents for serious study has become increasingly evident. The light that these recordings can shed on not just the individual musicians they represent, but also on many questions regarding performance practices during the 20th century, has been readily acknowledged, and this has provided the basis for scholarly inquiry on many occasions. One of the most fascinating areas of this part of recorded history is the availability of examples of composers interpreting their own works. I'm thinking not just of Elgar, Stravinsky, Copland, for instance, all of whom left recordings as conductors of their major orchestral works. I'm focusing more on such pianist composers as Prokofiev, Bartok, Shostakovich, and especially Rachmaninoff. All these gentlemen and many others like them have left for posterity an irreplaceable body of evidence about how they themselves chose to interpret their own piano works. During the next few minutes, I want to concentrate on Sergei Rachmaninoff, his recorded legacy in particular, revisiting the extent of what we have from him, playing both his own works and interpreting those of other composers, and looking also at the overall significance and usefulness of his recorded interpretations. In other words, the potential application of what we can gather from a serious examination of the Rachmaninoff recordings. At first glance, the topic of Rachmaninoff on recordings might appear simple and straightforward. After all, we need only walk into the nearest well-stocked record shop and pick up a copy of an RCA package of 10 compact discs in order to obtain his supposedly complete recordings. And a further documentation on his activity as a recording artist is desired. Comprehensive material can readily be found by consulting an excellent book published about 8 years ago by Barry Martin called Rachmaninoff, Composer, Pianist, Conductor. The basic facts are well known. Rachmaninoff made his first discs for the Edison Company in 1919, switching a year later to the Victor Talking Machine Company, and continuing that association until his death, with his final recordings dating from 1942. Rachmaninoff also made a series of 35 reproducing piano rolls for the American Piano Company, or AMPICO, and these were made between 1919 and 1929. No broadcasts or private recordings of Rachmaninoff as a solo pianist are known to exist. Test pressings or other sources containing further performances not approved by Rachmaninoff, with a handful of minor exceptions, have also not been allowed to survive, despite a number of rumors to the contrary. The additional repertoire known to have once existed on these rejected recordings is rather tantalizing, as a glance at Rachmaninoff's session-by-session discography will readily disclose. We can also regret all the recordings that could and should have been made by Rachmaninoff, but never were, not to mention similar possibilities for many other illustrious artists of this era. For instance, it is completely within the realm of possibility that Rachmaninoff could have recorded his interpretation of such works as the Liszt Sonata in B minor, Balakirev's Islame, Schumann's Davidsbündler and Symphonic Etudes, the 24 Chopin Preludes, or any of a half dozen major Beethoven sonatas, all of which appeared on his recital programs in the United States during the course of his contract with the Victor Talking Machine Company and later RCA Victor. We can lay the blame for this unfortunate state of affairs, if we wish, at the feet of such short-sighted individuals as Charles O'Connell of RCA Victor, who rejected outright many such opportunities. But there, unfortunately, the matter now stands until we see the development of time travel enabling us to select specific time-space coordinates and go back to when Rachmaninoff performed, for instance, the Liszt Totentanz or the Beethoven First Concerto, record those performances inconspicuously with concealed digital equipment, and then carry back the results for everyone in the 21st century and beyond to enjoy. Lacking for now such an opportunity, let me briefly summarize what does exist beyond the contents of the RCA Complete Rachmaninoff Collection, as it is known. Then I'd like to offer a few musical examples from these and other recordings. As with many published editions of various kinds that are self-described as complete, we might observe that all are complete, but some are more complete than others. It would be tempting to go through Rachmaninoff's entire discography item by item and comment on all the distinctive characteristics of his pianism and musicianship, but I'll forego that temptation and single out some examples that may generate questions and comments, if not definite answers. These questions may be somewhat provocative, particularly about Rachmaninoff versus other players of his music, and about the benefits, actual and potential, of his recorded legacy to serious pianists and listeners. First of all, if one really wishes to possess as complete a Rachmaninoff collection as possible, it will be necessary to obtain all three takes of each of the sides that he recorded for Edison in 1919. Only one of each is included in the RCA edition, but the rest are out there, and some, but not all, have appeared on other releases. To be sure, the differences among them are negligible, and it would be only for the sake of genuine completeness that a zealous collector or scholar would go after them. There's also a performance of his second piano concerto from 1929, assembled from alternate takes, that in essence consists, therefore, of a completely different performance, and this has most recently appeared on a compact disc from Biddulph. Again, the differences are relatively minor, yet noticeable if one listens carefully, and the same may be said of some surviving alternate takes of other repertoire, repertoire that is familiar from Rachmaninoff's approved releases. We're reminded that Rachmaninoff was an exceptionally consistent interpreter who, once he had decided upon his chosen approach to a given work, adhered steadfastly to that interpretation and rarely deviated from it to any significant extent. In this, he differed from his esteemed colleague, Joseph Hoffmann, who never played a work twice in exactly the same way, and who was always restlessly seeking new details and a high degree of spontaneity in his performances. That's reportedly one of the reasons why Hoffmann disliked the recording process, at least in terms of what he allowed to be released. Hoffmann abhorred the notion that a single interpretation would be frozen into the permanence of an issued disc, when so many other interpretative options lay before him. One wonders if these two titans of the keyboard ever indulged in philosophical discussions about their diametrically opposed attitudes toward the recording process. Beyond the alternate takes for both Edison and Victor that I have mentioned, there are a couple of other items that, for whatever reasons, did not make their way into the compact disc edition of Rachmaninoff's recordings. Neither is of tremendous importance, but both were briefly available on semi-private LP discs around 1969 and 1970. At that time, Rachmaninoff the pianist was very sparsely represented in the catalogs. One could usually locate his performances of his four concertos and Paganini Rhapsody, and perhaps his performance of the Chopin B-flat minor sonata, but a good many of his other recordings had not yet reappeared in the LP format. To fill a gap to some extent, private entrepreneurs entered the picture and produced their own reissues of selected Rachmaninoff 78s. These were available if you knew where to look. One noted source was the now-defunct Manhattan record shop known as Music Masters on West 43rd Street, presided over by the late Willie Lerner. For a slightly inflated price, you could ask for a disc on the private MJA label in a plain white sleeve marked Rachmaninoff Rarities. The three letters MJA supposedly were the initials of Mr. Lerner's three daughters. A second disc of similar yet different content appeared on the private Opus label about a year later. Long-term members of the International Piano Library, the predecessor of the International Piano Archives at Maryland, when it was based in New York, knew that these and other private discs of other historic pianists could be obtained from the IPL. These LPs could also be credited for bringing collectors, for the first time, hitherto unreleased Rachmaninoff recordings of the Chopin Third Ballade and Third Scherzo, and this was several years before their first so-called legitimate release in the 1973 RCA Centenary Edition on 15 LP records of the complete Rachmaninoff. Now, pertinent to today's subject are the two most intriguing items from those private LPs that I would like to play in the expectation that some of you might not have encountered them before. One is a brief speech by Mr. Alexander Greiner of Steinway and Sons. He was for many years the artist's representative of that illustrious firm. And Mr. Greiner offers his personal recollections of his friendship with Rachmaninoff, and then he introduces a private recording made at a party in Rachmaninoff's home, in which Rachmaninoff accompanies his Russian friends singing a tune called Bublichki. Greiner states that the recording comes from 1933, although I have seen no concrete proof of that fact. It's entirely possible that this recording was made at the same time as the performance of Rachmaninoff's Italian polka, played by him and his wife, that is included in the complete CD package. In any event, we have these two homemade recordings captured on a primitive disc cutting machine in rather poor sound. Here is Alexander Greiner with his introductory remarks and personal reminiscences and the recording of Rachmaninoff as accompanist at his home party sometime during the 1930s.
At 10 o'clock, it was 5 minutes past 10, or 5 minutes student that was exactly 10 o'clock, but just as exact he was in everything, he expected the same exactness from all the people with whom he dealt. And perhaps because I also am quite sure we have never been slightly misunderstood. If anything happened, let me say to a piano, all I had to do was to telephone him or write him, but they tell him about it. And he would fully understand, never complain, he was never fussy, he knew what he wanted, and all he expected was careful attention to everything that was to be done. It was not only a privilege, it was a real pleasure to deal with an artist who was so considerate, so understanding in everything. If something was done to please him, he would never forget to say thank you. Every year, when he arrived for his prostitute from Europe, one of the first visits was to sign the ball to meet our president, Mr. Theodore, his time. And always, at the end of the tour, before he left for his home in Switzerland, he would come to invite Napoleon to say to our president, thank you and goodbye.
Another Rachmaninoff recording, not to be found in the RCA compact disc edition, although admittedly not one that brings us any fresh repertoire, is a recording from 1935 in which Rachmaninoff plays his transcription of the preludio to Bach's unaccompanied violin sonata in E major. There is a well-known 1942 recording of this work from Rachmaninoff's last recording sessions that was published. Actually, two different 1942 takes have surfaced. Here, however, we have an earlier attempt at the piece, just 2 years after the transcription was written down, making the distance of 7 years between this and the officially issued version a matter of some interest. Not surprisingly, Rachmaninoff's basic conception of the music remains the same, yet as might be expected, there are a number of details of phrasing and emphasis that make this version well worth investigating. Here is that 1935 performance by Rachmaninoff, never officially released, of his transcription of the opening movement of the Bach solo violin sonata in E.
Thank you.
like to shift focus now onto an aspect of a well-known solo piano piece composed by Rachmaninoff, one that has been recorded many times by many pianists. I refer to the Prelude in G minor, Opus 23, number 5. To refresh everyone's memory, here is the opening portion of that piece. That was the playing of Mr. Vladimir Ashkenazy of the opening of that prelude, and we'll hear a slight additional portion of it in just a moment from Mr. Ashkenazy. But the detail I want to draw to your attention is one that I have not seen discussed in any of the literature, but it does connect directly with the issue of performance practice in Rachmaninoff's music. It raises the always fascinating question of deviations from the printed score, especially when Rachmaninoff himself is the pianist deviating from his own score. The passage I have in mind is the very ending of the prelude, and here are the final bars of that prelude in the recording by Mr. Ashkenazy, who follows exactly what Rachmaninoff has written. Now let's listen to the same passage as recorded by Rachmaninoff himself on the early acoustical disc of the G minor prelude that he made for the Victor Talking Machine Company on May 17th, 1920. As you can hear, Rachmaninoff adds two chords to the end of the prelude, one quiet, the other loud. Neither of them is indicated in the published score. This cannot be called a momentary whim on the part of the composer. His artistic temperament, for one thing, did not function in that way. For confirmation of how he preferred to end this prelude, we have an Ampico reproducing piano roll that was made exactly 1 month earlier. Here is the conclusion of the prelude on that Ampico roll by Rachmaninoff. As you can clearly observe, at some point between the publication of the prelude around 1901 and the occasion at which he recorded the piece in 1920, Rachmaninoff obviously reached the conclusion that his original ending was not exactly what he wanted and that two additional chords were required. To my knowledge, no revised edition of the score was ever published. Therefore, all printed versions omit those two extra chords at the end. All pianists undertaking to play the prelude thus have only one basic published version as a reference. What is surprising to me, however, is that after examining dozens of recordings of this piece by dozens of different pianists, I have yet to encounter even one who has chosen to follow Rachmaninoff's own example by adding the two extra chords. If anyone is aware of another pianist who has done this, I would be delighted to hear about it. Part of the reason, of course, may be that many pianists are simply unaware of the existence of Rachmaninoff's own recording, in which case ignorance and lack of curiosity would be the operative factors. For those who have heard the composer's performance and still persist in not following his example, one can only speculate, and I shall leave that opportunity for another occasion. Just to illustrate, however, that the ending of that G minor prelude has been subjected to even further tinkering, and this time not by the composer, I would like to play three further recordings of the concluding bars. Here is the first of those three. That was Mr. Vladimir Horowitz, recorded in 1931, when he gave a rather slapdash reading of the prelude on side 10 of his recording of the third piano concerto. Now we move ahead exactly 50 years later and find Mr. Horowitz on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House in New York at a recital where he offered the same G minor prelude as an encore. And here is Horowitz 50 years later with the concluding bars of the same piece. And as we can hear in the later Horowitz example, he eliminates the arpeggiated rewrite from 1931, but has decided to add one of the two extra notes to the end of the prelude. Now here is one final example, which is sort of a marginal item, but I couldn't resist including it nonetheless. There exists an orchestration of this G minor prelude by one Lucien Caillé, employed by the Philadelphia Orchestra to do certain orchestrations, including an alternate version of Mussorgsky's Pictures in an Exhibition, if I'm not mistaken. And this orchestral version of the G minor prelude was recorded by Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Here is how the prelude ends in this particular orchestral treatment. Now I would like to follow up that example from the G minor prelude with two passages extracted from Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. Perhaps not coincidentally, both come from cadenza-like sections in the second and third movements. Turning to the third movement first, I'm going to play the very opening of that movement, and I want to focus your attention particularly on the entrance of the piano with its cadenza-like passage. First, here is a modern recording of the opening of the third movement in which the performers adhere strictly to what Rachmaninoff wrote. And by way of contrast, I would like to play a somewhat earlier recording of the same section of the third movement, and note particularly the same entrance of the piano and what follows. As you undoubtedly have guessed, this is Rachmaninoff himself in 1929 on his second or electrical recording of the concerto with Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra. And as you can hear, Rachmaninoff prolongs the initial notes of four consecutive divisions of that cadenza, even though no such instruction can be found in his published score. There are a few pianists, such as Earl Wilde, who have chosen to follow Rachmaninoff's example in their handling of that passage on their recordings, but not many. I don't doubt for a moment that had Rachmaninoff originally notated the passage this way in his original published score, all pianists would have followed those instructions religiously. The fact that this is, again, a second thought, or a revision, if you will, that occurred to him after publication, but is known to us only by way of a recording, seems to be a well-kept secret among most performers of the concerto. They would, of course, be free to reject this evidence, but it's my distinct impression that the vast majority either do not know of or simply fail to notice this evidence. Here is one final example, also taken from the second concerto, but this time from the cadenza that occurs about two-thirds of the way through the second movement. I would like to pay particular attention to what happens after the extended high trill in double notes, where after which you will hear four arpeggiated chords. Here is a modern recording that follows what Rachmaninoff indicated in his published score. Now, once again, turning to Rachmaninoff's own 1929 recording made in Philadelphia with Stokowski, here is the same passage as recorded by the composer himself. As anyone looking at the published score is aware, Rachmaninoff instructs the pianist to play each of the four arpeggiated chords with a different dynamic, beginning piano, then mezzo forte, then forte, and then finally fortissimo, producing the effect of a gradual crescendo. The composer himself, however, totally contradicts his own written instructions and reverses that dynamic plan, in which I believe is a perfectly valid and convincing alternative to what appears in the score. Yet once again, this is a case where very few pianists have chosen to follow the composer's example. In an age devoted to the supposed pursuit of authenticity, may I say that I find this to be rather puzzling. Having given you those several examples from the G minor prelude and from the second concerto, as recorded by Rachmaninoff, the question arises as to what we should conclude about the significance of these Rachmaninoff performances. I can do no better than to quote the late American pianist, composer, author, and broadcaster Abram Chasins, who incidentally knew Rachmaninoff personally for a number of years. In his book, Speaking of Pianists, first published in 1957, Chasins has this to say about Rachmaninoff's recordings of all five of his works for piano and orchestra. Chasins says, "Let us check the scores as we listen to these recordings and see what we can observe. Does Rachmaninoff rigidly obey his own metronome marks to the numeral? He does not. Do the composer and his favorite collaborators adhere devotionally to the printed dynamics? They do not. It soon becomes obvious that public performance brings not only inspirational flashes, but also practical realizations that demand anything from slight alterations to flat rejections of the text. Finally, can we find symbols in the score which would enable an interpreter to achieve the glowing nuance, inner phrasing and subtle accentuation, the exquisite transition from one tempo to another, or from one texture or expressive range to another, or any of the other effects that ravish our ears? Not anywhere. There are no such symbols. What we do find is that Rachmaninoff, the interpretive genius, brings to Rachmaninoff, the composer, the identical disciplined originality that he brings to the communication of a work by Beethoven or Schumann. He has a way with music and with the piano which is entirely his own. The most personal and surprising effects emerge with such coherent relation to the whole that they stand vindicated as concomitants of the entire structure. Such playing is not performance, it is recreation. We now ask ourselves, continues Mr. Chasins, what are the applicable values of this authentic document? Is it to be regarded as the model for others to imitate as closely as possible? We see immediately, if we recognize individuality as the distinctive characteristic of a great interpreter, that imitation is impossible, even if it were desirable. What then is to be extracted from the composer's approach to his own music? Before a performer's imagination can take flight, he must be in full possession of every possible fact relating to the music he hopes to communicate. Here is where the composer's interpretations become invaluable. Rachmaninoff's performances of his own works provide the authentic basis on which we can verify compositional style, judge tempo markings and dynamic signs, correct misprints, and adjust miscalculations. The composer's readings show us what not to do. They chart the boundaries of our liberty. They disclose what would lead us too far afield. Beyond that, the interpreter is on his own. He must go on to realize the music through his own image, his own truth. The richer a performer's imagination, the greater his command, the deeper his intuition, the more humane his culture, the more he will penetrate and fulfill the potentialities of the music he plays. And with those words of Mr. Chasins, I think I've come to the end of what I wanted to say about Rachmaninoff interpreting his music. And if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to take them. Yeah.
Does the acoustical recording of the second concerto have those two changes that you know?
An excellent question. I was going to mention that, yes, if we go back to 1924, when Rachmaninoff and Stokowski made their initial recording of the concerto, the same characteristics are there, the same changes from his printed text. And evidently, he changed his mind about the handling of those passages at some point between 1901, when the concerto was completed, and 1924, when he and Stokowski made the first recording.
My other question is, I'm the one that supplied Mark Thorne with the records for the alternate takes, as well as the information that exists. In doing some research at RCA, I found that the artist folder that in 1952 somebody falsified the ledger and showed that the nine sides that were the alternate take that had been substituted somewhere in the early 1940s were now given the designation of M, whereas they had originally been given the designation of HC. And I'm at a loss to figure out why somebody falsified that, because I had to go back to the original bound the bound volumes with the original designations to note that the original set from 1929 through the 1930s had an entirely different set of designations. Additionally, we did a computer check of what was existing in the vaults, in metal parts and possibly also shellacs, and there are third takes of about four or five of the sides that exist as well from the 29 recording. So there are three takes, although again, only two takes of nine of the 10 sides are available because those are the only ones that were issued. But RCA holds third takes of about four or five sides.
I have no explanation for what transpired in 1952. That was the time at which the performance was reissued as an early LP, and it was later noticed that in fact that LP contained different takes from those present on the original 78s.
It could be that the issued metal parts wore out.
And somebody wanted to...
Because when they do the first transfer of the CD, all the metal parts were just actually shot. Yeah, but the metal parts that they did for that transfer were of those alternate takes, because of the fact that that falsified ledger sheet shows that those were the M takes, but they weren't. Those were the HC takes. So all of the producers of all of the microgroove issues had been deceived as to which were the takes that were the original M's and which were the ones which were originally HC, because those designations, except for that one side where there were no alternates, there were only two takes recorded and one of them was destroyed. So there's one side, I think it's side three or four, Inside Four. That's the only one that there was only one take, so that's the one which is consistent. But the other nine sides, the official designations were changed in 1952, and nobody decided, except for, you know, until I looked at it, look at what the original sheets from 1929 said.
Too much time has obviously elapsed for us to track down the culprit who did it. But if we were closer to 1952, it would be very interesting to know what was happening at that point. But indeed, that is what happened. Yes?
I just wanted to make a comment. I want to thank you for this very strong paper, and all the papers have certainly been strong, I think. Sort of preaching to the choir. I think something like this is what Arsh does best. I'm right now writing an article and trying to convince others who perhaps do not realize the value of recorded sound as research tool, and something like this really hits up the scholar that yes, the recorded sound is yet another and very important research item and not just the printed word. So again, I think this is what Arsh does best.
Thank you for the comment, and if anyone has brilliant ideas as to how to create a better awareness of the value of recorded interpretations, we can only quote Stravinsky, I think, who at one point, after he had made many recordings of his own music, he may have been questioned by Robert Kraft, but he did confess at that point that he regarded his recorded performances of his music as an indispensable adjunct to his published scores, and that anyone serious about performing his music needed inevitably to consult both his score and his recorded performance if they wanted to get the full picture. So at least in the case of Stravinsky, he acknowledged the value of the recorded performances. Gary.
Has there been any word from BMG about the cause of the deterioration of the early pressings of the complete Rachmaninoff?
You're thinking of the defective CDs in the initial manufacture of the set that had...
They're deteriorating just as the early Caruso sets did.
Gary knows the answer, although I think they became aware of it and have subsequently corrected the problem, but Gary has something...
They correctly, this happened to both the Caruso and the complete Rachmaninoff sets. BMG did replace mine and those of a friend of mine and sent them back. What seems to have happened is that they used some kind of solvent-based ink on the labeled side of the disc, and eventually the solvent began to break down the plastic. And when the disc started to go, they would first start to look cloudy, and they'd feel sticky to the touch, like you poured turpentine plastic, and eventually, in the case of the Caruso set, they got so mad that they developed a spider web appearance on the backside. It looked like something out of a Stephen King movie. And needless to say, they would not play, but it appears RCA never came clean with exactly what went wrong, but that would appear to be what happened then. So there was some kind of solvent used in the ink, and it eventually broke down the plastic.
I think it was the red ink in the Caruso.
Replaced them.
About 2 years ago, I think it was, I don't remember which issue, in the postscript section of the sound recording reviews, I gave the person and the address to contact to get those sets replaced.
Probably not there. I would like samples of the defectives if anybody has.
Mine took 10 weeks to be replaced, but it was replaced. So as a footnote, we'll mention that little fact. One last question, yes.
I'm wondering, what's your opinion of the piano roles of Rachmaninoff, especially in their latest incarnation that Wayne Stanky has done, released on that?
If we had another hour, we would get into the very thorny question of piano rolls versus everything else, which is a big can of worms to open up. I'll summarize by saying only that I think the results that Mr. Stanky has achieved on his two Telarc CDs, which, as most of you know, embrace all 35 of the Rachmaninoff rolls through his digital scanning of them and a program hooked up to a Burzendorfer 290SE piano, have accomplished the most musically convincing results we have yet heard from reproducing piano rolls. That doesn't mean necessarily they are definitive, but I think he has extracted all the usable musical information that was present in the rolls as accurately as possible. but it will not eliminate the Rachmaninoff disc recordings by any stretch of the imagination. And I think the serious Rachmaninoff scholar, or just those who are followers of him as a pianist and composer, will want to listen to both the discs and the Mr. Stanky's reproduction of the rolls. I think his, as I say, supersede earlier attempts, but there are certain elements present in the disc recordings that are unique to them. For a lack of a better term, I call it a subjective human element that comes through without technological intervention that one can sense in listening to them. But I would recommend the rolls as being a rather impressive accomplishment in that particular field, and perhaps it'll pave the way for better results than we've had before with other reproducing piano rolls. Dennis, yes?
It's fundamentally the wrong piano.
There is that factor to keep in mind. Rachmaninoff was, throughout his American career, a Steinway artist who played nothing but Steinway instruments. Mr. Stanky's reproduction of the rolls takes place on a Bösendorfer piano, and anyone sensitive to the different tonal qualities of different pianos will notice that the sonority of the Bösendorfer piano is not the same as it would have been had a Steinway been employed. So there is that element, I suppose, of distortion, if you want to call it that. Inauthenticity is perhaps the best term that must be kept in mind. In Mr. Stanky's defense, I will say that in the 1980s, he approached Steinway and Sons to see if they would be interested in working with him to use a Steinway instrument for the system that he devised. They were not interested, so he went to Bösendorfer instead. So be that as it may. My time is up, so thank you very much.